Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Women and girls have been missed for so long, and why do you think so many are now getting diagnosed for ADHD?
Hello, I'm Kat Brown.
The author of It's Not a Bloody Trend and No One Talks About This.
What was the catalyst that made you really go for an assessment of ADHD?
Having failed IVF, there being no embryos, there being no children, and having other people not going, oh, Kat, your sad, tragic little book, but going, my determination for medical reasons. It's made me feel seen in a way that I didn't know. This is why I think it's so important to find somebody whose story sounds like yours, even if on the surface you have absolutely nothing in common. When I was on my own, there were so many critical voices in my head. I'm awful. I'm rubbish. What did you say to that person today? You're going to flunk out of university, and then what's left for you? And I know what I thought about that at one point. I did have, like, suicidal ideation.
When I heard the word, you have ADHD, I felt a huge sense of relief. When you heard those words, how did you feel in that moment? Kat, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's delightful to be in the ADHD Chatter studio.
Thank you so much. It's fun, isn't it?
It is. I love the neon.
I was reading your book and I read some interviews you did, and I want to read some quotes back to you. This isn't one continuous quote, it's a couple joined together. Living with ADHD made me feel defective. Ever since I was a little girl, I felt that there was something deeply wrong with me. I went through crap, felt like an alien. All of these things are probably very relatable to the listeners. Could you explain a little bit more about how you felt at that time?
Listening back to it, it sounds really miserable, doesn't it? It's like a sort of misery memoir section. Actually, newspapers keep dropping me emails and going, do you have any strong emotional feelings about this? And I'm like, no, because I've had a lot of therapy, and I recommend everybody else does as well. Before we started the interview, we were talking about the fact that I'd grown up in the countryside and nowhere like colossally rural, but arguably in the 90s, before we really had the internet, mobile phones, anything really like that, there was this huge sense of you were here and nobody else was. And similarly, when you don't know that there is perhaps something that might be helpful to you to look into, particularly around how your brain works, which, let's be honest, when you're 8, 10, 12, is not necessarily something you have any interest in at all, you are just going to feel quite, oh, okay, well, this is just me, and maybe I just need to try something different, or I don't understand why the ways that other people behave either upset me or I see through them in a sort of way. I just found a lot of the social, I don't know, lubricant, the sort of oil that greases everything from primary school to playgrounds to, you know, being dragged out at drinks parties when your parents have got their friends are and having to behave and all that sort of stuff. I just found it quite difficult to know what gear to slip into. Whereas even if you've been diagnosed reasonably early, mid in life, as I was at 37, or if you're somebody who really only has found out about this quite late on, 60s, 70s, 80s, even by that point, you've learned enough about life, about society, about people, about yourself, to be able to sort of operate in those areas, even if it's just sort of selecting a different mask from the shelf. But, you know, at that age, you don't know about masks. You don't know about anything else. All that you know is that whenever you try and behave like yourself, people seem to find that wanting, or they might call you sensitive or weird or sad or something like that, depending on how old they are or who they are. And so there's just going to be this feeling inside you. Anybody, I think, who has anxiety, which is, again, such a mimsy word for something that is quite a violent feeling, will sort of know that roiling inside where it just feels like all of your innards are wrong. They're sort of boiling away on the wrong setting. And when you feel at odds with what's going on around you, particularly as a young person growing up and trying to, you know, explore or expand, use all the areas of your imagination in a sort of safe way, then those sorts of knockbacks from people, whoever they are, can really just start, you know, leaving their marks on you.
And I suppose over time, they compound, they add up, and they chip away at your self-confidence, self-esteem?
Hugely. I mean, this book has been such an eye-opener for me because I've learned so many things through doing it, which is a relief because with the best will in the world, like 3.5 years of hyper-focusing on everything to do with ADHD is not the same as, you know, decades of clinical work and research and so on. But I spoke to Shaimal Mashru, who is a psychiatrist who has worked, to his estimation, with around 4,000 ADHD patients in differing, you know, levels of experience. And when I was sort of finding out about ADHD myself through my diagnosis and understanding about all the comorbidities that can come alongside ADHD, I'd always thought that it was maybe just they got sort of plopped in and sort of happened alongside. And I really hadn't put two and two together and realized that a lot of them can be caused by experiences in our life. It's not the same as trauma. And again, that's why it's so important that, like, somebody who not only has real experience of working with ADHD, but also a lot of other conditions and experiences, is the one doing your assessment. But Dr. Mashu explained that, for example, anxiety, depression can be brought on by repeated exposure to people telling you negative things about yourself. And that's not the same as going, you know what, setting yourself on fire is not a sensible action, so I'm going to go and make you stand in the corner for 10 minutes or whatever. It's not the same as just being rebuked as a child or, you know, having to learn the consequences of your own actions. I mean, some of the things that I was told at school, all of which I have, you know, dealt with, lived with, and that sort of thing, they really effed me up. Because they were contrary to the message that I was telling myself, which is, you're doing quite well. Look at you in school and having done your homework and all that sort of thing. I'd also been moved up a year at school when I was 7 because I'm also incredibly tall. So that meant that weirdness, otherness, and that sort of thing was just compounded by immaturity and the ultimate 90s crime of being ginger in a playground. So it was really interesting for me, whilst researching the book and all the other ways that anybody with a late diagnosis goes and looks up everything about this new understanding that they're developing about themselves, to find out all of the different ways that it kind of mapped out over your life thus far.
Even if you didn't have that awareness of masking that you've got now, looking back retrospectively, do you think you were masking when you were the young girl in school?
I definitely did as we went through senior school, just simply because I sort of started off like a cheery little balloon animal. And then just, you know, after, there's only so many pops you can take. This is a terrible metaphor. A balloon animal can take one pop and then it's gone. So let's just, made up of more balloons. This is really awful. I must stop immediately. But by the time I'd got to sort of my third year, my fourth year of school, so the years before GCSEs and that sort of thing, I knew that I couldn't not behave in a sort of weird way, but just sort of that whatever I did or said, there were going to be consequences. Some of it was physical, a lot of it was verbal. Some of it was verbal and incredibly funny, which is one of those really awful things that never turns up in books where bullying is featured, is that, you know, sometimes the bullies are really, really funny and you're just like, oh, why are you doing it against me? And it's like, well, somebody has to, and the butt of the joke is you, and you're 6'1" and you're like orange. So at some point that sort of, you know, all comes together, and it's a challenge. But the places where I retreated were stereotypically and pre-internet books and my friend's Super Nintendo, because I didn't have one and I was obsessed. But books where, you know, people might be different to children in their classes, but where in books, if they didn't get the good lines now, then a couple of chapters down the line, they were going to get the good lines, and whoever was saying horrible things would get their punishment. But also that sort of wish fulfillment was almost by the wayside, because it was far more about these characters, whoever they are. And ironically, some of my favorite books are written by an author, L.M. Montgomery, who quite a few scientists think, looking back, possibly had ADHD. And certainly those traits are very evident in a lot of her principal characters. But it was, for me, the biggest satisfaction was about seeing these characters thrive. And so even though I, you know, had to go back to school the next day and something tedious would happen and some child would just behave like a idiot, that I would be able to entertain myself by finding these three stories.
I read in your book, and I know you couldn't find your school reports when you were trying to find them for the assessment, but do you remember what your school report said, if you think back?
Really good in some subjects, fairly abysmal in others. I think it is reasonably lazy to think that somebody who is creative in a language way will, you know, therefore not be as competent in a numbers, maths, sciencey way. But the very fact that I forgot what the word maths was and had to call it numbers is, they were not my strong points at all. So anything where I had a real interest, I absolutely thrived. And I might get told off basically for either not paying close enough attention or not working hard enough, because some of these subjects really came quite naturally to me. And so therefore, you know, if I wasn't interested enough, then, you know, I'd have a good old daydream or just not really be paying attention. But then also there was the fact that I was a year young for my year. So I'd missed out this fairly key learning about how to be a person at school. And so that could always be an explanation. I also ended up having what was called putty mal epilepsy in the 90s and is now, I think, called absence seizures, which is a type of epilepsy, which amazingly turns out to be fairly common as a comorbidity in children with ADHD. And so absence seizures really are just almost like daydreaming on an epic scale. They happened in the middle of my piano exams, in the middle of class, when I literally had my hand up, when I was crossing the road. So all of these things together would just be an absolute jumble of just not paying attention, silly mistakes and all of that sort of stuff, particularly in subjects where I really did have to like work quite hard just to stay up at sort of base levels. And it was a huge relief to me when we got to GCSE and I could just drop down into the lower levels, because there was no way in hell that I was going to get more than a B if I was lucky in biology or maths or something. So rather than then, you know, trying desperately to make something work and make something fit, I could just sort of ease into it and not necessarily enjoy it, because, I mean, my God, who enjoys learning around GCSE time? But at least like fear it a bit less.
You said the horrible bullies, and that's nasty. And on the other side, were you able to maintain friendships? Did you have friends back then?
Yes. I had some really good friends, and they wouldn't necessarily last for hugely long, but I'd also have perfectly pleasant relationships with other people in my year. And actually, one of them came to a book launch that I had recently, which was just lovely. And I've reconnected with a few people from school over Instagram. Like, social media in general has been really useful for me, not just as a research tool, but or just, you know, seeing other people. But some people have come back into contact and just sort of like, oh, what you're doing is really interesting. This is great. And then I've been able to find out what they're up to. Mm. And I think the danger of being like, oh, I was bullied at school and it was all very tragic, is that then it just becomes a thing that is just on your shoulder your entire life. And God knows, as adults, we have enough of those happening around us in our everyday lives without having to go, oh, that time that teacher was quite mean to me on a school trip to Germany, it was quite upsetting. It's like, I'm 41, I've got bigger fish to fry. But it's so nice, actually, seeing the people that I've been in contact with, like, over the years. Like, everybody's just grown up now. Mm. Nobody is who they are when they were, you know, I was 10 when I went to secondary school, and awful, would not recommend that to anybody, but nobody's who they are at 13, 17, 18, 21 even. Like, there's, I find it quite reassuring that there's this thinking now that, you know, adults don't really become sort of physically completed adults really until sort of about 25 in terms of brain development. Although then you go back and watch films from the 60s and 70s and you're like, well, you were running a household by the age of like 15. So, you know, I'm just here going, oh, I'm just, you know, a bit anxious actually. But it's all comparative.
One of the key points in your book early on, and I make a lot of content about this as well, so I was keen to ask you, is why do you think women and girls have been missed for so long? And why do you think so many are now seeking assessment and getting diagnosed for ADHD?
I think the second part of that is probably a bit easier, which is that certainly so many women are finding out about ADHD because their children are going through assessment. And, you know, I couldn't find my school reports, but those are useful, obviously, as tools of indicating what you were like as a child. So, and it doesn't have to be a woman, obviously, but a parent sort of taking their child through this assessment, sitting with them and that sort of thing. Bells are going to start ringing. Also, other people have been listening to like more coverage on things like Woman's Hour and, you know, TikTok, Instagram and that sort of thing. And also, like attracts like. So if one of you in your friendship group gets diagnosed with something, particularly like ADHD, then you're going to look around your close friendship group and there may be some traits that you all have in common. Mm. And that's absolutely not to say all of you have got ADHD, because they're just that, they're traits. It's not a diagnosis. It's not like when we all used to walk around with half a Forever Friends friendship necklace or something like that. But I suppose one of the other truisms that has gone around is that, you know, for years the focus in research, in diagnosis, was on small, hyperactive white boys. And I mean, I've interviewed a number of middle-aged white men for the book who were also missed. So it's not to say that if you were a white man, your life was absolutely going to be amazing because you were going to be diagnosed at a young age. I think also, and this is purely anecdotally, but from people that I've spoken to, my own experience is that once women or sometimes female identifying people find out about something, your instinct is just to be like, I'm just going to zoom in and just inhale all of the internet and see what's happening. It's like those memes about if you want to find somebody, just tell your friend Sarah the first letter of their first name and she'll get up. School, education, fifth jobs, you know, who they're going out with now and that sort of thing. So again, once you find out more about that, and perhaps if it ends up speaking to your experience, because I think one of the really fascinating things about ADHD is that it is just looking like it's like looking at a smashed mirror, basically. Everybody's experience is so incredibly different. And yet, listening to people talking about their experiences, I mean, it's like being in a recovery meeting. Listen to the similarities, not the differences. The feelings will be similar. Experiences in certain areas might be similar. Finance, particularly, a huge one for me, and certainly for lots of other people. But again, not everybody. If people were taught coping mechanisms or how to manage their money, how to not just budget, but how to, you know, pass bank statements and that sort of thing, and it was drilled into their routine at a young age, then that may not be in their story, but there will be so many other elements that are similar there. And lots of women talk to lots of other women. And then that's just such an easier way of finding out, you know, is this normal? What's going on? And that's not to say that, you know, women talk to each other about everything. I've literally just written a book called No One Talks About This Stuff, about baby loss, childlessness, infertility, all the other fun, lovely things I like to fill my time with. But it's often, you know, now we're living in a time where, you know, naysayers might call it oversharing. If you are, for example, a male doctor and the host of one of my favorite podcast series, it will be said that you are simply exploring a topic through your own lived experience. But now we are living in a time where it is just simply easier to find out about things and to find people who are speaking about it. We have podcasts now. We have podcasts consisting of interviews, which wasn't really the case when they started 20 odd years ago. Yes, we've got TikTok. Yes, we've got Instagram, but also, you know, YouTube. Mm. And these are all places where it's not, where people can go off and explore in their own, in the privacy of their own homes. It's not like one TV, four channels, everybody's got to watch the same program. It's not like, you know, you've just got more, you've got the ability to be more private and to be not necessarily secretive about it, but just to explore these things in your own time. Mm. And that in turn is incredibly valuable for people, men and women, who are finding out this new thing about themselves that is sort of taking them on this new, you know, journey, but is also going to explain quite a lot about, you know, what's happened to them, where they've been and who they are.
Mm. What is your personal journey through that look like? What was the catalyst that made you really go for an assessment of ADHD?
I'd given up drinking alcohol the year before I was diagnosed, and that really showed huge gaps in my coping mechanisms. I went from drinking alcohol to basically being even more obsessed with black coffee than I had been years before when I was drinking it to a quite problematic level. I'd also a few years previously been treated for binge eating disorder, which was another surprise because I had no idea this even existed. And whilst I wasn't binge eating anymore, I was still very much relying on certain foods or, you know, comfort foods, certain things with certain textures to sort of distract me or bring me down if I was anxious and that sort of thing. And then, a few months before I gave up drinking, my husband and I had two failed cycles of IVF. And the reason given was that my eggs didn't mature enough to fertilize. And I mean, I obviously went immediately onto Instagram and couldn't find a single hashtag about immature eggs that was about infertility. And I went on all the forums, nothing either. And it was just like, oh, this is not great. And then in just before the pandemic, we were going to go to another clinic and start again, not really start again, but we were going to take out a whopping great big loan and do what there's probably a proper term for, but I essentially called all you can eat IVF, because the idea is you keep going until you have a baby. And if you don't have a baby, you don't pay for anything. And if you do have a baby, then you pay for it with probably a lot of your mental health and your stamina and your resilience, probably your will to live. And also about £14,000. Mm. So we'd just been told that it just wasn't recommended, even by a clinic that was going to charge us this. It's probably risen significantly by now. It just wasn't recommended that we proceed with it. And we were just sort of trying to come to terms with that and lockdown. And I'd already been looking into adoption over the last year, podcasts again, some amazing, amazing series, but from incredibly generous people about their experiences. I actually found the LGBTQIA+ podcasts like the most reassuring to me, because I've never felt like a normal person. And I don't mean that in a sort of, Alex, I'm really special and I'm going to be in a film very soon and it's all going to be very special. I'm going to, I don't know, climb Mount Olympus or something. I just didn't feel like a regular other person. Mm. And I just, so hearing from other people's perspectives, and again, this is listening to the similarities, not the differences, was incredibly helpful. But I went to some of the open days around adoption, as much as you could when you're in a pandemic. So it was all on Zoom. And I just thought, it's not even that I don't have the energy for this next path, bearing in mind that all of the IVF and everything was on, you know, several years of trying to conceive naturally, which is just the most dispiriting, knackering. I mean, it's almost like the epitome of mindfulness, because you are aware of every single day in your flipping cycle. And it's just, it's a way to make your relationship the least romantic thing under the sun. So or just all of that sort of came together. And I was like, I just don't think my brain is here to be able to cope with that, regardless of the adoption process, because you need to be pretty tippity-top to be able to then raise a child, let alone a child that it probably has had a fairly traumatic start to their life and maybe several years old. And that's a lot for them, let alone you needing to be strong, and not just strong, but also really like together and you know, having looked after yourself. And so we'd made this decision that we weren't going to go ahead with it, which is pretty freaking bleak when you've got like an hour of walking a day. But again, this is the same thing with both of these books and just life in general. Like, everybody's going through some pretty heavy stuff. So when I saw one of my favorite people who I follow on Twitter, because she always retweets the most amazing stuff, she retweeted this question from an ADHD coach asking, if you were diagnosed with ADHD as an adult, you know, what gave you the tip off, basically? And I love all this stuff. I love finding out about people. It's basically why I'm a journalist. I'm just inherently nosy. I mean, you can call it curious, it's nosiness. And I just went down this thread, and male, female, whoever they were, it was just like somebody going, Kat Brown, this is your life. This is why this bit sucked. This is why you were so awful with money and couldn't budget to save your life, even though you tried to read books about it and websites and everything. This is why your finances suddenly took a massive upswing once apps were introduced. Once everything took an upswing, once you could outsource it somehow, just outsource an element of your head. And I just sort of read to this end of this thread and then started on that huge Google search that I mentioned earlier, read everything about it, as much as I could, and sort of put together a sort of mini TED talk in my phone, and then went off to see my GP and was just like, I think I found like the ultimate reason for why I have so many flipping medical conditions or, you know, frequent flyer points and all that sort of stuff. And not all of it was connected, but so much of it was. And just that moment of just being like, oh, it's not like waiting to see what thing's going to be wrong with you next or something. It all ties in together. And it was just the most extraordinary feeling.
There was a summary of that TED talk of evidence. What would that look like?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Depression, anxiety, insomnia, binge eating disorder. I mean, things that I know there's more of them. I used to sing them along to a song, like the fast food song. ADHD, ADHD, insomnia, depression and anxiety. It was just all of these things together and just going, look, this is why I've had problems with addiction as well, using that as a coping mechanism. I mean, I got put off going into recovery for literally 10 years because I was like, well, you know, I don't drink in the morning. I don't drink during the day unless, you know, we're at work and it's somebody's leaving or something. And I'm not a middle-aged man with a red nose and a park bench. Mm. There can't be anything wrong with me. And I think just being able to have an idea for why I was experiencing all of these things. And I went into it with just literally like, rather than a sort of emotional aspect, because a GP doesn't want to hear that when you've got 10 minutes tops. But just being like, I think honestly, this would explain so much about all these random things that I've experienced or been treated for. And that the idea that they could just fall under this umbrella, and if we treated that, we might get rid of all of the underlying symptoms, says woman with modern languages degree and absolutely no medical qualifications whatsoever. But I was like, we'll treat the big boss problem and then all of the other little ones will disappear. And I was just so delighted because the person that I spoke to wasn't patronizing. She was interested. She said, I don't know anything about ADHD, so please bear with me. And I was like, oh, well, you know, I've been Googling this for at least a week and a half now, so bear with me. And I was just so thrilled that she put me forward to speak to the mental health team. And then they put me on the waiting list. But the waiting list, and this is such a, you can tell this was a little while ago, the waiting list was a year, and I thought that was too long. It actually turned out to be 3 years because I got a call. I accidentally stayed up on their list and I got a call whilst I was writing the book saying, oh, we're about to arrange your assessment. And I was like, I was diagnosed 3 years ago. I went private in the end. That impulsivity, that bad finances, I basically used my tax savings to go privately because I didn't realize how many other things are tied into assessment. But either way, I don't regret it because it's the story that I've taken.
Mm.
And the way that everybody comes to any kind of understanding around themselves is so unique to them, which is why it's impossible to sort of follow somebody's life and hope that it will be the same for you.
I remember when I heard the word, you have ADHD, I felt a huge sense of relief, validation, grief. When you heard those words, how did you feel in that moment?
I sort of cry laughed. He said, oh, you've got X percentile likelihood of combined type ADHD. I was just so delighted because I was like, I've been trying so flipping hard for so long and I keep getting things wrong. Like the harder I try, the more I get things wrong, the more I will upset people, the more I will, you know, confuse family members or, you know, alienate friends or that sort of thing, or just not get on at work. And just having this explanation was just, I don't know, it was like the combination of at the end of a Disney film, like characters walking off into the sunset together and then that little circle coming around before the credits coming up. I mean, it never obviously focuses on what happens afterwards and what they, because they have to flipping carry on walking. And it's not like the red velvet curtains come in and then that's it. Your life is sorted. You've got ADHD now. Well done. There will never be any problems again. It's like, no, life problems will carry on happening. It's just now you know you have ADHD.
I read in your book, Kat, that your mum didn't believe in mental health.
Yeah, she was quite cross with me. She read the book, my family's been really supportive about this, although slightly confused about the fact that I've had two books come out in like 2 months, which is frankly just bad scheduling.
It's very ADHD,
exactly. And she was like, it's not that I'm not going to try and paraphrase my mum, but it was more that the generation that my mum grew up in and our family as well was reasonably military. And I think just nobody knew about mental health. ADHD is not mental health. That would be depression, anxiety, my absolute hatred of getting out of bed in the morning, that sort of thing. But it just, there were so many other explanations for what was wrong with people if you were a reasonably successful white British man. You might be, like, I had a great uncle who was a medic, and I think one of the university bars in London was named after him briefly for a time, and the ceiling was just flooded with champagne corks. God knows where all these medical students got the money for it, but still. But he was always, you know, described as eccentric, which is sort of like a classic tell. Scatterbrained was another one, absent-minded.
Mm.
All of these people were allowed to be because they had people keeping their homes going. They had housekeepers. They might have had wives. They might have had, you know, servants, just people to keep things together. Like secretaries, teams of people sort of stopping them from falling apart. But also, I think it's because the things that we now know of as being neurodivergent were then often just looked on as personality traits. And certainly, if we go further back, like into the 19th century, when the worlds for everybody were really, really small, not, you know, necessarily in a bad way, but people might have travelled less far and that sort of thing. So then if you showed any kind of social difference, that was really going to limit, you know, maybe marriage prospects. That might not matter if you were a, you know, wealthy genius with your own massive private income and that sort of thing. Like, people would overlook a lot.
Mm.
But if you were, you know, lower middle class or something, and marriage or something was going to help you come on as a person, or really as a status symbol, if you were somebody going into a profession, then having something wrong with you or being a bit odd or something. I mean, in all these different circumstances, it's only embarrassingly recently that we stopped tying the hands of left-handed children behind their backs at school. I read a wonderful paper by a chap called Chris Chris, I'm going to completely butcher your surname. It's either McManus or McMahon, who did a wonderful study on handedness, which is what anything to do with left and right handedness is called. And that's a neurodivergence as well, because which hand you write with is wired in your brain. But saying that the percentage of people who were left-handed had risen, not massively, but from about 3% towards the end of the 19th century to around sort of 11% at the time that he was conducting this study. And it's not that people suddenly were like, hey, you left-handed, let's get it on and make a load of left-handed babies, which you'd probably have to do if you wanted to, I don't know, increase the ginger population, for example, because both of the parents need to have that recessive gene. It was just simply people were allowed, you know, to go through school without being, you know, beaten in a lot of cases if you dared to write left-handed. And if we need a fairly clunking parallel for pretty much anything now, whether it's the trans community, whether it is neurodivergent people, you know, there wasn't all this in my day. Oh, there absolutely was. It's just chances are it wasn't considered nice. So it was hidden away because it wasn't normal. And that is basically where we get tied into the overlaps between fear and stigma.
So it's fascinating. I was thinking about this earlier. So you think if the rise of awareness with the left-handed population was in the modern day, people would be writing articles saying being left-handed was just a trend. Do you think there is a similar comparison?
So the difficulty, well, not difficulty. I mean, firstly, people knew that it was a physical thing because they were physically tying their hands behind their backs and making them write with their right hand, making them build up that muscle to do it. But also, like, handedness is completely visual. Anything in the brain is not. And that is where I still see that we are, as a society, certainly in the West, still a bit like, they're putting it on, really, aren't they? They just want to get benefits.
Mm.
After my entire newspaper was shut down in around 2009, I was on benefits for a bit because I really stupidly was just like, oh, I don't think I want to freelance. I want the security, another job. And it's like, okay, well, whilst you're doing that, you're not going to get any work. So off to, you know, Peckham Dole office, go you, to the job centre. That is, people who say that you might be lying about having something different wrong with you, however you want to phrase it, to get extra benefits has just never had to try and live on the paltry sums that we try and make people live on. And luckily I wasn't on the dole for very long, partly because Peckham Job Centre kept going, oh, there's a job going for diplomatic editor at the Daily Telegraph. Isn't that your field? And I was like, I am an arts journalist. I write about Pokemon and the Archers. No. Plus I'm also 24. But it was still just that, you know, I think people like to think that life is simpler than it actually is. Mm. And that goes to whether that is that they want to believe that people who are experiencing real difficulties and need some help, you know, are just trying it on. If that makes them feel better about the fact that there are really stark economic differences in the UK that have only got more pronounced over the last, since 2007. I mean, fine. If that's what helps your worldview, fine. But a lot of these people have large platforms and are also content to trumpet their views around quite significantly. And whilst, you know, lots of people might be able to see through that, lots of other people either won't and they'll go along with that and be like, oh yeah, they're talking sense. Great. This makes me feel better about the views that I might have been feeling a bit dodgy about. Or for people within those groups, I mean, it's not exactly going to make any of them feel better, is it?
Mm.
We only have to look at the headlines doing the rounds, the TV shows sometimes around ADHD, either just being a trend. And yes, I did choose that title simply so people could just pick it up and go, it's not a bloody trend. It's just, no. But also as a, not as a comeback, because it doesn't need a comeback, but to all of those stories, those pieces, those comment ones, just going like, is it real or are just people, you know, a bit snowflakey and they can't deal with stuff? It's like anybody that gets diagnosed with ADHD has probably been through quite a lot in their lives that is on top of the quite a lot that is simply being a human person in the world. But it's also why I ended up ending the book with something incredibly dry, which is like pure science. It's an extract from the 2021 consensus statement around ADHD by Stephen Farrioni, who very kindly let me quote it. Because a consensus study is when you essentially make a giant sandwich of studies with minimum 2,000 participants, like really good, big, chunky, meaty studies on a subject, and you get them cross-referenced by a significant number of other experts across the world. So it's not just like, you know, John down the lab is just going to go, oh, that looks great, Dave, love it. It's brilliant. Sorry, Johns and Daves, but still. It's just really boring, concrete, objective findings. And there were 200 plus in this consensus statement, and a lot of them are not thrilling reading because they're facts.
Mm.
We've got too used to facts having to be juicy or exciting. And it's like, no, that's talking points, that's comment, and we can't confuse them. But it's also because I know that there will be people who get to the end of this book and have probably read an awful lot of other books as well, podcasts, TV, films, all that sort of stuff, and still go, okay, but that's fine for them. For me, though, I'm still like a defective avatar in a meat suit. And having that just objective fact about ADHD, about the difficulties that come not just to an individual, but to pretty much everybody in their orbit, including like global society, global economy for people that really are, you know, obsessed with how expensive, you know, funding all these assessments is going to be. I just wanted to have that in there because I'm a good writer and I can convince people of a certain amount of things, but I can't convince people that what they have gone through in their lives is a legitimate thing. Not when you have other people who are also very convincing going, it's all made up. It's a trend. It's basically just people want something to be interesting about them. You know, people just aren't resilient. People aren't strong. People are the most resilient and the strongest who have got to this point in their lives and are still alive, for one thing. Amazing side effect of undiagnosed ADHD. Early death, suicide. I just needed that to be in there to go, if you don't believe me, this is fine. But just have a look at this, because this is hundreds of people. People who don't have modern languages degrees and don't write about the Archers and Pokemon, but just really boringly, objectively going, not just that it's real, we're not talking about Father Christmas.
Mm.
It's true.
It's a great factual end to the book to demonstrate that it's not a bloody trend. Kat, I ask all my guests to tell me an item that most represents ADHD in their life, and you have brought this thing with you.
Yes.
And I'm going to need you to explain what this thing is.
So this is actually a sculpture by the Finnish artist Mari Kazurinen, and I'd love to say that I found it in an art gallery somewhere. Mm-mm. I found it when I was working on the London Paper website in the sort of mid-aughts. And when we were having to put together galleries that would get loads of people clicking and that sort of stuff. And Mari Kazurinen is an artist, like a pop artist, who takes My Little Ponies, and I love this one because it is Gen 1, which is what I had in the 80s, and she modifies them to look like pop culture characters. I mean, all sorts. This is Rogue from the X-Men wearing her TV outfit. The X-Men's recently been rebooted on Disney Plus. I think it's X-Men 97 now. And I just loved this. Firstly, because I really adored the X-Men growing up. Great cartoon, also a great metaphor for any kind of difference. It's been used as a metaphor for civil rights, for LGBT rights, for everything, any kind of difference, and also sort of negates that lovely idea of ADHD as a superpower, which was incidentally invented to cheer up children. Mm. Adults don't need to take that. But the X-Men always showed that, you know, you can have superpowers, you can look great in Lycra, and you can still have the most monumentally screwed up private life. But I also got this because I was earning buttons when I bought this sculpture. And in about 2008, this sculpture cost me 330 euros. Did I have 300? No, I flipping didn't at all. But I bought it. And the amount of impulsive buys that I've had, whether it is, you know, oh, I'm just really into scented candles at the moment. Could you not choose candles that cost 60 freaking quid? Or alcohol or karaoke or rounds of alcohol and karaoke to keep people going because I can't face being on my own. Any kind of thing. So Rogue Pony now sits on one of my bookshelves at home, and I don't look at her and go, oh, you idiot, why did you spend 330 euros? I go, well done you for being here with your bookcases, which you have lovingly organized so that you can look at them without your brain, you know, pinging off them. And you have a mad 330 euro pony. It was either going to be this or my Apple Watch, but, you know, you're getting this off my wrist when I die. And I hasten to add, this was secondhand off eBay. That would be the other thing that sort of helps me the most. But yeah, so I can't possibly part with Rogue Pony. So I've printed you out a beautiful greetings card.
Yeah, thank you. It's fascinating.
A portrait.
You can pop her next to the books if you like. So she's still front and center for the rest. What a visual.
I mean, it is uncanny. She's she's a great artist. Her Catwoman one is one for the ages. Mm. And ditto Alien. Literally any character that you can think of, she's done. It's extraordinary.
You mentioned something that I really resonated with, that you can't stand being alone. Is there something deep there, or you just get frustrated with no company?
There was for years. I just couldn't be on my own. And it wasn't like I needed to be doing something. It was more, particularly when I was at university. This was years before I started getting any kind of diagnosis of anxiety. Like all of these, not even diagnoses, but these treatments that would sort of trickle in like every few years. And I'd be like, oh, okay. But then there'd always still be something else wrong. And for me, it was just when I was on my own, there were so many critical voices in my head. You know, I'm awful. I'm rubbish. You know, what did you say to that person today? You're going to flunk out of university and then what's left for you? And I know what I thought about that at one point. I did have, like, suicidal ideation has fortunately not been something that has dogged me all the way through my life, but it has certainly been there at certain key points to a borderline unmanageable degree. But just that feeling of just being scared of being alone with your own head, which again was why alcohol was so helpful, because I could just numb it out. Mm. Why food was so helpful. Again, just, you know, go into a zombie trance, have a binge, eat the right foods. And that's not the right foods as in an avocado and some seeds. That is particular types of cookies from the supermarket, or, you know, crispy chocolate or that sort of thing. All of these things just to try and make you feel less alone. But don't do anything, because you're always going to be there. And another recovery saying, wherever you go, there you are. And that's not the same now, partly because, you know, as we all have, I've done a lot of work. I'm by no means like fixed. I mean, which is ridiculous because I'm on your podcast and I'm wearing a fabulous suit that Shoni Wilkinson wear to depict ADHD. And I look pretty good from a distance. But it's still such a work in progress. And that's partly ADHD. And that's, again, it's life. It's humans. Mm. It's dealing with, I had a hip replacement a couple of years ago. That threw me massively off being able to use exercise as a coping mechanism for my brain because I couldn't bloody move. But stupid thing kept dislocating all the time. Mm. I'm only just now getting back to that. But exercise that I enjoy, or if not enjoy, enjoy having done, and understanding my brain more, knowing that actually I do need medication beyond my ADHD meds to work with anxiety and depression and that sort of thing. I feel like I'm more of an ambivert now than an extrovert, when really I was just sort of almost not necessarily sucking the energy out of other people, but I just needed to be constantly around other people. Whereas now I can take it or leave it, and I'm very happy in my own company. Although you might not think that to look at me, because I will be whizzing around doing gardening, doing the laundry, finding things that need to be fixed. But I'll be listening to a podcast while I do that, and I'll have a lovely time. And it's just so lovely to know that things are different now. Because I just, for years, just thought, well, other people don't experience this, and this is just going to be me until I drop down dead.
Mm. We know that there's a significant uptick in alcoholism or alcohol use disorder within the ADHD community. With you, was there a particular catalyst that made you stop drinking, or was it a gradual process over time?
Gradual and very sudden. I'd been circling around the idea for genuinely about 10 years. And this was such an indicator of how paranoid about it I was. I bought what in AA is called the Big Book. And to somebody who's a newcomer to recovery, is a fairly impenetrable, dense text until you hear people reading sections about it. And you're like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe I can hear myself in these stories. But again, I didn't see myself in the idea of alcoholism. And again, this is partly why I've written like these books, because I felt like I just wanted like a boring old normal person. I wanted to hear boring old normal person stories in both infertility and loss and with ADHD as well. I mean, to be fair, none of the scientists are boring old normal people. They're freaking rock stars, but still. I've completely gone off my train of thought. There we go.
Oh, no. I mean,
it was the recovery, wasn't it?
Yeah, if there was a particular catalyst that made you stop drinking, or if it was a crisis point decision, or if it was just a very conscious decision to stop.
A while after the IVF, one of my friends died, which is, again, not an excuse, it's an explanation. And the night before I stopped drinking, we were all going to go and see Fleabag at the theatre, and I went into WhatsApp to see who was coming. And she had given a message saying that if I'm still alive, I'm definitely coming, and she wasn't. So I used that as an excuse to think, right, I'm going to go and toast my friend. I'm going to go to the lovely wine bar, very civilised, across the road from the theatre, and I'll raise a glass to her. Bearing in mind, she barely drank at all. And then went to the theatre, drank some more. Don't really remember seeing Fleabag. Sure, it was very good. And then afterwards, everybody else went off. My husband, I was just like, oh, can we go to this restaurant for supper? Can we go to this restaurant? And I tried to tick off all these like booze things that used to almost act as an upper, like a nice cocktail, steak dinner, all that sort of thing. And it just got to the end of the meal, and we were waiting to get an Uber home on Haymarket, this dating it massively as a time when you could afford an Uber off Haymarket. And it's just there going, I didn't feel anything from that. Like nothing. And it was just such a waste. Like I'd had plenty of what, you know, might glamorously be called like rock bottoms or like fairly catastrophic things that happened, although touch wood, I'm incredibly lucky that nothing worse happened. But like, I certainly rippled onto other people's lives horribly. And so the next morning I was just sitting at my desk at work and just Googled, as I had done many times before for a support group. And as luck would have it, there was one 5 minutes walk away and there was a meeting starting in about 15 minutes. So I went, and it's been bloody hard not going to the meetings or speaking to other people, but living without that coping mechanism. Mm. But peeling that away has just been one of a series of unpeelings that I've had to do, in terms of whether it's dealing with, you know, not having kids or, you know, not being able to use alcohol anymore, which was something that I had to mourn quite significantly, you know, stupid hip, and I'll probably have to have the other one done at some point. And the fourth one, ADHD. It's just like every now and then they would all sort of compound, and I'd just be sitting there sort of examining my little tragedies going, oh, it's really hard being me. And it is, but you know, everybody can say that to a certain extent. And the things that I have learnt from other people which is crucial because I isolated so hard after all of that combination of, you know, IVF and giving up booze and everything, even before lockdown. This is why I think it's so important, not necessarily to talk about things if that isn't right or appropriate for you, but for there to be people who do, and to be as many people as possible who do, so that you can find somebody whose story sounds like yours, even if on the surface you have absolutely nothing in common.
Mm. I think somebody, I can't remember who said it, the opposite of addiction is connection.
Yes.
Do you think you react particularly badly to rejection?
Well, yeah. I was fascinated again to learn about emotional dysregulation as opposed to RSD, which is just a term for those feelings that we can have about taking things particularly badly. And particularly, quite a lot of the, it's awful to say experts, Michael Gove has ruined the word experts for us all, but certainly a lot of the psychiatrists and clinicians saying that they are absolutely convinced that the next time that guidelines are overhauled, emotional dysregulation will be a key part of the criteria for a diagnosis. Because I really tried to be less sensitive as a kid, but I just couldn't stop crying or getting upset or just feeling these boiling, suddenly like from zero to straight out of the top of the thermometer responses to things. And as an adult, and without any kind of understanding, like pre-good therapy, because there's therapy and there's good therapy, and pre-giving up booze, and therefore having to, you know, focus a bit more, but also not artificially inflating my responses to everything, I would still find things incredibly difficult. And I would take criticism, but I would probably still go off and have an absolute sobbing fit about it afterwards. Because it wasn't that I couldn't necessarily see things in a balanced way. It would just be one part of my brain would be, I can see this in a very logical way and this is completely sensible. And the other part of it was, oh my God, I am being torn apart by knives and my body is being fed to wolves as we speak. And it's, again, it's one of those things that when you hear people talk about it, you're just like, even I, this is awful. This is also just my lovely 90s upbringing still kicking in, but just like, oh, pull yourself together. Stop being so flipping tragic. But with that emotional dysregulation, it's just that. It is just emotions all over the place where, in some cases where they shouldn't be, like really disproportionate responses to things. But then also there are places where actually what you are experiencing is a reasonable response to things. Ironically, like my husband and I adopted a dog in 2020, and we still do pass a series of really regular and rigorous checks with the charity. And one of them was that we had to join this dog training group who would like teach us about all these ways to sort of not just manage the dog, but learn about ourselves. Honestly, learning about trigger stacking in dogs. So when, for example, your dog who is normally totally chill, when let's take a stereotype, the postman comes round, has an absolute meltdown when your perfectly nice postman, who's always really sweet to her, comes round. It's very rarely going to be about the postman. It's going to be about lots and lots and lots of tiny, tiny little things that have built up over the course of that morning or that day and taken them over threshold. And oh my God, that was just such a lovely parallel for me and my brain. And also, to be fair, the vast army of nieces and nephews in my family, just again, understanding, you know, my brain particularly, but also just having this lovely term, this lovely visual that I could use. So if I'm finding something more challenging than usual or somebody more irritating than usual, then usually if I work back a bit, it's like, well, it's because you're not flipping Superman. And, you know, these things have all added up. Plus you're worried about that that's happening next week. You've got to finally send off your marriage certificate to go and get your pensions sorted out because that's been hanging over you since last August. And you're really freaked out they're going to lose them or something, or that it's going to take ages. So just being able to pick those apart and then figuring out, oh, well, that's why I completely overreacted to that. But generally, as long as I sort of keep to a reasonable routine and do now bring in the exercises that I can do and try and get enough sleep and just make sure that I'm not, you know, gargling with M&Ms before bed. And it's a massive, massive help.
Do you think it's possible to tell the difference between a irrational response to a criticism or a rejection and a rational one?
Well, they're both going to be rational in the most literal sense of it, because your brain is like, oh my God, a bear. And it's like, but it's not a bear. A few years ago, I really got into horse riding, which I'd loved as a child. And then I went to the 2012 Paralympics and saw the para dressage and was just like, horses are amazing, must start it again. And it was absolutely terrifying. And it wasn't terrifying because I'm really tall, so the horses I ride are quite big. Actually, that usually means they're much slower than the ponies, who are just absolutely terrifying. But my responses to everything was just mad. I mean, objectively, like, I would have like real over-the-top panic responses to going around some corners sometimes. And I'd usually end up in tears, and my poor riding instructor would come up, and the amount of times that she'd say, Kat, it's supposed to be fun. You know, you're paying for it. It's not supposed to be torture. And I'd just be there going, I don't know what's wrong with me. I ended up having hypnosis for this, for goodness sake. I mean, hypnosis for horse riding, that's tragic. But at the same time, it was incredibly useful because I could take apart what I was worried about, would go through these feelings over and over again and just sort of, you know, work through it. And actually, it just ended up being that partly it was all of the things going on in my brain that I didn't know about, but also it was all of these worries that I'd had the last time that I'd been riding, which is about like 15 years before, very briefly, just all of these things that I'd sort of still kept in my body and worried would happen. And again, one of the reasons that I've got not over that, but through that, and I do take this as a parallel to everything else that I experience with ADHD, is partly the sort of 10,000 hours of practice. I'm still an awful horse rider. My favorite t-shirt just says, I'm the world's okayest horse rider. That's great. I have okay tattooed on my wrist because perfectionism is very real for this woman. But also it's just knowing sounding like an awful, like, soapy self-help cliche, but just knowing myself more and being able to go, okay, well, this is why you're feeling this and why. And this is, again, where talking things through with somebody is so helpful, to get that, you know, with somebody trusted, whether it's a therapist or a loved one or a friend, it's just being able to get a second opinion or something and sort of analyze it that bit further, but without analyzing yourself into the ground.
I wanted to ask you about one of the contributors to your book. I think you spoke to someone called Professor Philip Asherson.
Yes.
And he said that there's a golden triangle of ADHD treatment, three pillars of ADHD treatment. Can you explain what they are?
Loved speaking to him. Professor Philip Asherson co-wrote with Professor Susan Young, who's also in the book, the 2008 NICE guidelines on ADHD in adults. So he knows what's going on. He was also sailing his boat around the Caribbean when I spoke to him. So he's having a lovely retirement. This golden triangle, I think, is such a massive thing of what is missing with these huge, huge waiting lists for NHS assessment. So the golden triangle of treatment for ADHD, as Professor Asherson understands it, and actually, I think, as we all should, is meds, if they work for you and you find the right combination, behavioural strategies, by which we say coaching, and just general therapy. So this is really specifically for adults. And the therapy is there, not just so you can be like, oh, you know, I'm just feeling like this with ADHD, but to literally process the grieving that you might really genuinely have around all the things that could have been different in your life if you had known earlier. Again, Professor Young was so adamant about the importance of therapy and acceptance work before we even go into anything to do with coaching or meds or anything, that I just chucked another chapter in the book about it. It's a really, really huge part of it. I mean, I try not to have any regrets in life. I've screwed up a lot, so that is quite challenging. But I have objectively, extraordinarily successful friends in really like varied areas who are not still, that's to say there's a, you know, that there's an expiry period for it, but who really grieve the person that they could have been if they'd even known in their 20s. I mean, I actually dread to think about the person they would have been, because that person would have been probably insufferable in terms of just the level of their success. But it might also have been so different. And then meds is another one that people have lots of, you know, different thoughts about. And I have to say, not all of these thoughts necessarily come from reading robust scientific criticism or analysis or research, and often just tends to be on a whim or what, you know, somebody's told you, which is ironically, you know, very useful in some respects, but you need to use your own judgment for it. I mean, ADHD meds are absolutely by no means perfect. And I really genuinely thought it would be a question of the magic pill, in which I then, you know, take it and maybe, I don't know, morph into somebody from Captain Planet or one of the X-Men or something and just, you know, take on a special costume in which I'm Cat, but better. If you're just given the pills, I mean, Professor Young again, she's got a lovely phrase, which is that, you know, pills don't teach skills. And part of the reason, in fact, the main reason that lots of people are getting assessed for ADHD is because it is the only way that you can be prescribed medication. But to be prescribed medication and then just, you know, off you go, there you go, that's a nightmare. Because you haven't been, you've still got all of your awful, probably, for me, coping strategies in place, which essentially just make you look like, I don't know, the beast's castle in the woods, just surrounded by gnarled trees, as you're like, okay, well, I have to do this because otherwise I can't do that. And I get really tired at work in the afternoons because the lights are so awful. So I basically need to have three coffees at 2 p.m. if I'm any chance of staying awake through that meeting. These are not good behaviors. I mean, they're behaviors, but they're not helpful. So we need to find ways of accessing therapy and coaching. Therapy is, it's not easier, but in terms of finding somebody who is objectively qualified, at least there are, you know, there's the BACP website, which sort of, you know, has all the certified therapists on there, and you can search ADHD and so on. Coaching, though, that's really challenging, particularly as, you know, Instagram and TikTok have thrown up a lot of people who are like, oh, I discovered I had ADHD and now I'm a coach. And it's like, great. How do we know what these qualifications are? Are they good? So one of the ways that I did access ADHD coaching was going through the appallingly named government scheme Access to Work, which is nothing about unemployment and is all about support for people. And this is interesting, with or without a diagnosis. So the newspapers might, you know, make a fuss about it and self-diagnosis and everything. But, you know, the government literally doesn't. Although it does then make you jump through so many appalling bureaucratic hoops, particularly if you, like me, are self-employed, that it will make you question why on earth you're doing this. But I did have coaching through that. And if anything about Access to Work was structured in a remotely non-Wonderland fashion, it would probably have been more helpful and consistent than it was. But I'm still glad that I experienced that and have a few more strategies to add to my arsenal. But also, there's so much good stuff on YouTube. And Jessica McCabe, who's just brought out a book, damn her, but is absolutely brilliant. And her YouTube channel helped me no end, not just in my early days of trying to find out what the flipping Pomodoro technique was or anything like that, but just, you know, unpicking these different sort of coaching ideas. Because I think we can sometimes think that coaching is about, you know, got to, you know, self-optimize and become the best that we can be. But sometimes it's about going, okay, what's the obstacle to you actually having breakfast in the morning? Or we're going to work backwards from your binge in the afternoon when you're like, why am I suddenly just inhaling cake? Or even if it's not somebody's birthday, we're going to work backwards from there. So again, it's having somebody just quite calmly, but in a non-therapeutic way, be able to take you through things specific to you that cause you in your life, in however that shows up, whether it's, you know, family or work or different, you know, different types of juggling things or chronic illness, all of these things, all of these intersections that make life, you know, life, which is, you know, great and challenging in equal measure.
You said in your book that there were positives and negatives to your ADHD. And I was curious to know what the positives were and what the negatives were.
I mean, two of the positives are sitting in front of you. I mean, I find it mildly hilarious that even completely separately, published by different publishers, my brand is apparently blue and yellow. That's wonderful. The ADHD book was written and published and pitched in under a year, which for traditional publishing, and sorry to all of the non-publishing geeks here, is just unheard of. Like, publishing is slow. It's not necessarily reactive. It's famously, you know, oh, this book is going to come out in, you know, June 2027 or something like that. But then the other one was not traditionally published. You can still get it in bookshops. It's still a normal book, quote unquote, because that was hugely important for me as somebody who has felt hugely stigmatized around all elements of infertility, because obviously for me that really intersected with not feeling like a normal woman because, you know, oh goodness, I've got a deep voice, I'm very tall, a redhead, I'm awful at basketball, what? And, oh, I've got ADHD. And so I went with a publisher whose model is crowdfunding. And that book took about 3.5 years from start to finish. And the amount of effort to be positive, to bring people along on your journey, because you're the one crowdfunding, as it turned out, 20,000 flipping pounds to get this book that you know will be really important to so many people. And other people are just like, oh, is this like your next take on running a marathon? That is a humble brag. I have indeed run a marathon, hashtag ADHD. I couldn't have done any of that without the passion, the purpose, the absolute cast iron knowledge, not that I was just doing a good thing, but that this was something that needed to be in the world to slowly expand these bookshelves. And I'm thrilled that, like, the ADHD book is doing, you know, it's doing well in terms of I'm getting so many messages from people about, oh, this bit has been really useful, I really love that. And to all of those people, I would say, please leave a review on Amazon, honestly. No, not really, but still. But the other one, it was just, the response to that was like, it was like nothing I could have imagined. Because as miserable or difficult as I found, you know, life with untreated ADHD, and it's been amazing, don't get me wrong, I've had an absolute ball. Grief and the disenfranchised grief, that grief that isn't recognized by a society, of having failed IVF, not even getting to the stage that, you know, people doing IVF usually do, there being no embryos, there being no children, you know, names being taken up by other children, those timelines in which your children would have existed and had those names, it's just not. And having other people not going, oh, Kat, your sad, tragic little book, oh, poor you, but going, I had a termination for medical reasons, which is one of the essays covered in the book, and I just collapsed inward and didn't know what to do with myself. But reading Hillary Freeman's amazing piece of writing about her experience in the book it's made me feel seen in a way that I didn't know. And that is what I'd forgotten that I'd written the book and the ADHD book for, is because whilst we think that everybody has the same access to support, that's categorically not true. And the same channels that, you know, might be really popular in certain circles or might be really well discussed, you know, you walk into another circle, nobody's heard of them at all. So again, just by being able to have these, I mean, and I, again, recovery has been incredible for me, flipping hard, but I think of them as support groups in a book. I think there's so many negatives of ADHD that are fairly well worn, but they can often seem completely intangible to somebody who's looking at you and like, oh, you're middle class, you've got makeup on, you're wearing a nice suit, you know, you seem reasonably successful, what could possibly be wrong? And it's for that, it would be like when you see a beautiful shell or rock on the beach and you pick it up and then it's all filled with wet sand and little worms and everything. And that's fine. That's just the way it is. But for me, the underside of ADHD, even now, treated, therapy, you know, done some, you know, books, all absolutely fine, is things that if I get overly stressed or life becomes a bit unmanageable, I mean, which obviously it will do for everybody, then things can absolutely spin out of orbit. I'm trying to be really sanguine about this and not be ashamed about this, but I lost my engagement ring last month. My finger had swollen up and I was about to go and do some exercise. And I thought, okay, well, I won't put it on today. And then a week passed and I still hadn't put it on. And it's now like 3 months later. And because I've been completely preoccupied with other things, I have absolutely no idea where my ring is. I've looked all around the house, everywhere else, and it's just not there. And instead of tearing a strip off myself, which I have done so many times before, because losing things, you know, it's a stereotype for a reason, just the brain just not latching onto this. I'm kind of gutted that I didn't have an AirTag or like a tile attached to my engagement ring, but it's only a flipping finger. You don't think you're going to lose it. And then I think also, like, in order to be able to make life work for me at the moment, to be able to do like joint rehab, that's literally on my hip, and the therapy and everything else, I've taken a step back from like full-time office work also, because I just found that quite overwhelming. And so frankly, the amount of money that I make is, it was never, you know, fantastic. I was a journalist, for goodness sake. I still am. So I'm now a freelance one. So it's still probably even worse, but I'm just not earning very much money. And that matters to me because I still think of myself and my value externally and in society to how many hours I'm working a day, even if the way that I work is completely different to other people and the work that I'm doing is different. But also, I still mentally think you should really be an accountant. Just that underlines everything. Even though if I were an accountant, I mean, I hire an accountant because I am such a bad accountant to myself. But still mentally, there is still that thing just going, what you do isn't real. It's just not. And I would be saying that even if I was a flipping accountant, because that is just how my brain has been over the years. But I can hopefully, you know, have some grace with myself about it and be like, you know what, babe? You look back at the last 4 years, it's not been great for you. It's not been great for your husband. It's not been, you know, fabulous for people around you. So just, this is not a normal period of time. If you need to work in this way so that you can go and get your body to stop falling apart and hopefully get your brain to stop falling apart and everything and deal with quite a lot of heavy stuff with a 330 euro My Little Pony in your bookcase, then that's just the way it's got to be for the time being.
Congratulations. I mean, there's a huge amount of value packed into those two books. I was, you know, reading the ADHD one and heavily relating to a lot of it and just learning so much. So congratulations. You know, it's very, and for them to come out so close together as well, it's a very ADHD on Brad, right?
Truly.
Oh, Kat, every week I ask my ADHD community to send me their woes. It goes into the washing machine of woes and we'll see what they say this week and see if there's some relatability or advice from the guest. So this week someone said, my life is totally unmanageable. I love being creative, but I get overwhelmed by most of the things I know I need to do as an adult, like paying bills and staying organized. I want to see my GP, but I'm worried I will be dismissed because I'm not a hyperactive male. Any advice before I go to the doctors?
Such a lot, isn't it? It's so interesting that you've got the washing machine, because that is a washing machine brain right there. It's keeping everything inside your head and trying to keep all the balls juggling away and worrying that, you know, if you look away for even a moment that you'll drop one. Not people are always, that's a generalization, but anytime that the word list and ADHD come up together, there's almost a theatrical hiss response. It's like, I can't do a list. I've got ADHD. And it's like, babe, just trust me on this one. Even if it's not necessarily a list, having like two pieces of paper or whatever, one which is purely for creative, lovely things that brings this person joy and makes them feel fulfilled and wonderful, and the other for the scary crap, like my pension stuff, that is on a piece of paper. I'm dealing with that this week. I don't want to, but I've been putting it off for like nearly a full year. This is bad. Working through that, just literally putting everything down, getting everything out, all of the things that you feel really super guilty about, the things that you're just like, okay, I don't want to confront the fact that I haven't done that and that I need to do that. Even if it's a library book, which can give you the most guilt, because then you are depriving libraries of books, and let's flagellate ourselves with that for a bit. Tell somebody else. I mean, It's very unlikely that this letter has come in from a monk who is hermetically sealed in the world's only isolated monastery comprised solely of them. So if they have a flatmate, if they have a trusted friend, a colleague, even a family member, even if it is literally just Googling the ADHD Foundation or ADHD UK and finding one of the helplines, one of the advisors, and look, I'm a millennial, obviously I hate using the phone. Sometimes it is actually worth it. Sorry, that sounded really patronizing. It's never worth it, but in this case it would be. Mm. And then you've just got somebody completely impartial on the other end of the phone who you can talk through all of your concerns with and just be able to explore that more. But the really key thing is, just for God's sake, don't keep it inside your head, because either you'll forget it again or you'll forget it. And I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning last night and just suddenly went, oh, and had an almost like body spasm of guilt over something that I just suddenly remembered. And if you literally just get it down on a piece of paper, it's so basic, but that doesn't make it any less hard to do. Because, yeah, you can write, I can write beautifully, that's absolutely great. But if it is confronting what you were keeping inside your head, then getting that down is really difficult. But honestly, even just giving that a go and just writing one of those things down, you'll just suddenly feel like you've peeled something away.
Great advice. Just finally, Kat, we have a... I wanted to ask if you could go back in time and give your younger self, the little girl pre-ADHD awareness, some advice based on the knowledge that you have now. What would you tell her?
Well, as one of my favourite memes shows, young children mainly think that 41-year-olds are like impossibly old and probably about to die. So she wouldn't listen to me at all. So I think I probably wouldn't give her any advice at all. I'd just tell her what I think every person deserves to hear, whether they're children or adults, which is what my diagnosing psychiatrist told me after we'd titrated the medication, which is just, you've got through such a lot in your life, and to have achieved what you have done and to have got where you are and to have become the person who you are, and that stands the same whether you were at 7 or 41, you know, hopefully I'll get much older. It's just amazing. And having that validation from the psychiatrist was incredibly important. But I also think that's the validation that everybody needs to hear. And that's not in a sort of like, you're doing amazing, sweetie, sort of like Kardashian sense. It's just having that genuine, honest, and that awful, you know, lovely word that's, you know, always ends up being misused, but kind, authentic feedback from somebody that you love and somebody that you trust. It means the world, and it helps you to build self-esteem. And sometimes that person has to be you.
We have a bit of a closing tradition, Kat, on the podcast to ask you what your most impulsive thing is.
Oh, I'm really awful at forking my fingers and issuing curses to bad drivers when I'm driving. So awful. I think it's basically to sort of siphon off some of my road rage. So when I was at university, I found that a really good way of calming myself down or removing busy thoughts from my head was literally to make a physical movement like that and then just blow them away. And I'd find that really helpful. It's a little bit convoluted when you're driving, and I'm afraid I'm not as calm as when people insist on swapping lanes endlessly without indicating, which seems to be a horrendous new fashion. So then I'm afraid I fork my fingers and say something absolutely unrepeatable on a podcast or in polite society. And my husband is always horrified, but he's got mainly used to that now. But I'd probably do that even if there was somebody even more important than my husband in the car.
Yeah, road rage, very relatable. Kat, thank you so much. This has been great fun.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex. It's been a total joy.